Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Your hosts for today are Susan Franson and Ursula Rudenberg. Welcome to both of you.
I'm Susan Franson, and I'm very happy you are joining me today, Ursula. I know you've been thinking a lot about our topic today, and you've been helping me line up our distinguished group of guests talking about a very important issue, voting. The lead article in the opinion page of last Sunday's Des Moines Register was, "Do it now. Get that request for an absentee ballot mailed."
When I saw that, I couldn't help but thinking, isn't that rushing the season a bit? It's only August, and there's two full months until November 3rd.
That was my initial reaction, but I'd already heard a national commentator make a plea for young people to volunteer to serve as election workers because the usual retired people who fill those jobs on election day will be staying home because of COVID-19. My experience in the past was that volunteers for the various campaigns were hanging reminders on people's doors on election day, reminding them to vote. But I think door knocking is not going to be done this year.
Yeah, COVID-19 certainly changes things. But we all got used to it during the primary, when the Iowa Secretary of State absentee ballot requests were sent to all registered voters, resulting in the highest voter turnout for a primary ever.
Things have gotten a lot more complicated since June. To begin with, the Iowa legislature has passed a law that says the Secretary of State can't do it again. But more than that, this is exactly the time when thousands of people are moving into Ames and surrounding towns. Even if they're registered voters somewhere else, they need to re-register with their new address.
Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. That's why our first guest is Lucy Martin, the Story County Auditor, who can answer those and many other questions. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us, Lucy.
You're welcome. Good morning.
Let's start with the question Ursula asked. If you've moved, do you need to re-register?
Yes, unless you're a student, and I'll talk about students in a little bit. Anytime you move in Iowa, even if you just move across the street next door to a different apartment in the same building, you need to re-register to vote so that we have your most current address. And that's probably the number one question I ask people is, are you registered at your current address in Story County? So we do have forms available on our website. This is a postage paid form. If you have a printer, you can print that off, fold it up, and fill it out. Mail it to us. If you do not, please call the auditor's office, 382-7210. Or you can visit our friendly League of Women Voters. Carolyn's on the line with us today, too. The League of Women Voters in Ames and Story County is extremely active, and I'm very grateful. I'm also a proud member of this chapter, but they have done a great job targeting people that have moved into apartments, senior centers, and students to make sure that people are registered at their current address.
Who is sending out the invitations? Some people have gotten two or three.
Yeah, so when you come to absentee ballot requests, third parties can send those out. There's not a restriction in Iowa on that. So if it's for a genuine political purpose and requesting someone's vote is a genuine political purpose, lists can be purchased from the Secretary of State's office or the county auditor. So what we typically see, especially in a presidential cycle, is the major parties will send out requests, candidates will send out requests, not-for-profits, like I think it's the Center for Voter Information, which they send out both voter registration and absentee ballot requests. Those I've probably gotten the most questions on because there are some errors on those, and people get really concerned that their registration is not correct. I don't know what list they used. It wasn't something that they got from my office. They don't have to use a voter registration list. What they are looking for is likely voters, perhaps, or people that they think are not registered. There is contact information on those forms, but I know that my staff has fielded a lot of questions about where did this come from, is this correct? Am I really not registered? So there are a lot of people have turned in those forms, but it's also generated some unwarranted fears as well. So there's always good and bad with mailings like that.
Is there a way to check whether your registration has been received?
You can check if you're registered on the Secretary of State's website. What you have to know is your name that you're registered with and your date of birth. And I think your zip code. And it tells you if your registration is active or not, and it gives your polling place. What it doesn't do is say your address, because they don't want stalkers to use that or anybody that's trying to harm somebody. If the voter himself or herself calls my office and can answer some questions about their registration, we can tell you where you're registered. We can generate a new card for you if you would like one. But I can't answer questions like that for spouses. So like if Carolyn called and wanted to know if John was registered, I couldn't tell her. If Carolyn called and wanted to check on one of her grandchildren, I couldn't tell her that, even though she knows probably like where they live and what their middle name is and their date of birth. It has to be the voter. Those are two ways you can check your registration. If you call my office, it's a little more detail that we can give you. The Secretary of State will tell you, yes, you're registered, and this is your precinct, and this is your voting location. If you know your voting location and you haven't moved, that's probably a clear understanding, but it won't give the address where you're registered, and that's for the voter's safety.
Well, once you've got registered and you've got your absentee ballot requests and you've sent it in, you have to wait a while. So how can you be absolutely sure that your absentee ballot request made it to the auditor's office?
Right. So we've been receiving absentee ballot requests for the November 3rd election since early July, because we are not allowed to accept them until 120 days before the election. So right after the fourth holiday, we started receiving them. Because I have two special elections on September 8th this year, we did not start entering those right away because we didn't want voter confusion, but we started entering those in early August. Over 7,000 entries right now. If you have mailed in your absentee ballot request and it was properly filled out, so there hasn't been an issue, and we haven't contacted you about that, and you've been entered into the system, if you go onto the Secretary of State's website, there's a link on his main page that says track your absentee ballot. And if it's been entered into iVoters, which is the statewide database, it will say that you have, that it's entered in there. So we haven't entered every single one that we receive, because right now I get probably two tubs of mail every day. So there's probably a day or two lag on entry at this point in my office. But that is a way to track that. Now, ballots statutorily cannot be mailed out until 29 days before the election, which is October 5th. So that's the first day we'll mail ballots. But if you've sent something in recently, you should be able to find it in the Secretary of State system, and then it will go out on that first date. Right now, just so people understand, I don't even have the certified list of candidates of who's going to be on the ballot. The last certification date we get from the state is September 3rd. So after September 3rd is when we actually start creating the ballots. So everyone's like, well, why can't you send this out? One is we don't even know what's on the ballot. And two is, by law, that's 29 days before the election.
You mentioned name. I remember somewhere saying that your signature had to match the signature on file. And it occurred to me, my official signature includes my full middle name. My husband's does not. His includes only his initial. But if I forgot and I thought, well, maybe just my first and last name will do, would that be a problem?
Signature verification is not part of Iowa law. Some of the confusion we get, just based on the questions I've talked to voters about, is a lot of people get their information from national news, and there are different rules in every state. So you really need to get your information, if you live in Iowa, from Iowa. Signature verification was thrown out as part of the LULAC lawsuit in 2018. We do have everybody's signature on file. If there are other questions, we might look at that to make sure, but it is not part of the verification process. A, we're not signature experts, we're not trained in that. Also, people's signatures change over time. And also, people with mobility issues are allowed to use a stamp they're allowed to ask somebody to sign in their presence for them. That's a really rare occurrence, but it is under Iowa law. And signatures can degrade over time. And also people that have anything that affects their mobility might affect the signature. So we accept those at face value is the term that we use. If the voter has signed it, that we accept that as a voter signature.
Well, I know that a major part of your job from now until the election will be finding and training workers for the polls. And that should probably be more difficult this year. Because, by the way, what do you call them? Do you call them judges or?
No, judges is a term that's used in a lot of other jurisdictions. We'll call them poll workers is probably the standard form. Precinct election officials are PEOs is what auditors call them, because I believe that's what the code calls them. But a poll worker or precinct election official are the two terms that we use. And then each precinct has a chair, the person that's in charge. So that's what we call them here in Iowa. But I understand that a lot of people do call them election judges because they've either worked in other jurisdictions and that's what they were called, or they might have been called that at one point in Iowa. I've only been doing this for 16 years, so it's possible that the language has changed over time. Recruitment, honestly, it's not just COVID that's made recruitment difficult. Recruitment has been a struggle for many years, maligning my own generation, but older people seem a little more civic-minded, and it's something that they feel very strongly about. I think younger people, just their lives are so complicated. They have kids, they have older parents they're working with, they work out of town, their lives are just full. That unfortunately, I have a great pool of election officials, but they die frequently because they are older, just not to be coy about it. And I don't see that getting backfilled. Whenever I hear of somebody retiring, we try to recruit them. The Secretary of State's office has been very helpful in advertising, and they've sent a lot of people both to Story County and to all 99 counties. So that's been helpful. But I need a mix of old and new, because if I had, I'm going to hire something on the order of 400 election officials for November 3rd. If all those people are brand new, that's a really difficult task for everybody. So I'm hoping to have a blend of both old and new at the polling places for November 3rd.
Well, I recall that it's supposed to be bipartisan. You're supposed to have...
Yes, it has to be. There has to be a majority of not just bipartisan, but a lot of people are registered as no party. So I have to have a majority at the polling place has to be affiliated with one of the two parties in Iowa, which are the Democratic and Republican parties. So if there are 10 poll workers at a precinct, at least 6 of them have to be registered with one of the two parties, and it has to be a mix of parties as well. So I can't have I have to have a mix of parties, but I also have to have a majority of party-affiliated poll workers at each location.
So well, that really makes it difficult, especially my recollection is these are 16-hour days by the time you get
If you're lucky, it's a 16-hour day. If there's a line at your polling place, it could be much longer.
Yes.
Because so polls are open from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. for a federal election. The poll workers have to be there an hour before to set up. And then if there is a line at 9 o'clock when your polling place closes, all those people are eligible to vote and have to be processed before you can close down the election. And then it's not like you just shut everything off and you're done. There's a lot of reporting and tallying that has to be done afterwards, which it's a very long day. Carolyn has worked many years at student precincts and can tell you just what it's like. But it is a very long day. I guess when it's really busy like that, it does go pretty quickly. But it's extremely tiring. Your voice probably gets worn out. If you're shouting through a mask and a shield, it might be even harder at this point in time. And we do provide PPE to our poll workers, gloves, masks, shields, sanitizing spray. But we hope it's enough. I didn't have any COVID infections from June 2nd that I heard of. So that was a relief to my mind.
Well, is there anything that our listeners need to know from you before we...
Yeah, I'd like to clarify. So what happens a lot of times, first of all, you had asked about why people are asking so soon. Yes, we can't mail out ballots till October 5th, but the silver lining to all this, even though it's incredibly busy in my office at a point in time where we're not necessarily used to it being so busy, is that we have time to fix any issues that are on absentee ballot requests. And the missing information that we see, and the law did change as of June 30th, where we're not allowed to use best means available. So when I talked about iVoters, the database, we used to be able to, if you had forgotten your date of birth on that, we could look you up and add that form. Now we have to contact you if you've given us contact information. Most people do not provide that anymore. So now we have to send you a letter to have you fill in that new information. So this time between August and October 5th gives us time to correct those errors. So that's a silver lining there. Also, people talk about, well, there's absentee ballots and mail-in ballots and early voting, and that's all the same thing in Iowa. So whether you come into the office to vote, whether you request a ballot by mail, or whether you go to a satellite voting station, that's all absentee ballots. They're all processed the same way. Those are all counted by the absentee board. What happens a lot is we'll mail somebody a ballot and then they'll come in the office and they say, well, I got this absentee ballot, but I want to vote early instead. And it's the same thing. So we usually just have them fill out that ballot in the office and put it in the ballot box that we have in the lobby there. Those are all absentee ballot types. There's two ways to get a ballot. We can mail you a ballot, or you can come into the office and vote, or go to a satellite station and vote. We don't do takeout ballots. So I say, like, you can't get takeout. You can get delivery or you can dine in, but there's no takeout option when it comes to a balloting. So those are some frequent questions that we get from voters. And also, you can't, like, pick up a ballot for somebody else. That seems to be a popular question.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and answering answering questions people hadn't thought of yet. I know you have lots to do between now and November 3rd. So thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome.
In case you just tuned in, we've been talking with Lucy Martin, Story County Auditor, who will be responsible for registrations, absentee ballots, and all the polling places on Election Day. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today, Lucy.
It sounds as if the real job for the next 2 months will be registering voters. Our guests during the rest of the hour will be talking with us about this.
Yes. And I'd like to introduce all of them now so you won't miss their diverse stories. First, we'll talk with Carolyn Klaus from the League of Women Voters, talking about registering voters, which turns out to be a pretty big job. But today is a special day for that and for everything else. It's Women's Equality Day, the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment. And she'll be spending the rest of the day registering voters with Karen Kudrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women and Policy.
What a great day to celebrate. But even while we're celebrating the 19th Amendment to make it a full reality, later in the program we'll hear from Al Womble, chair of the Democratic Black Caucus, who's been working to increase political participation among black citizens of Iowa. But let's hear from Carolyn Klaus.
Hi, Carolyn. Lucy Martin told us about the work of the registrar's office, but there's a lot of work just to get the people registered to vote, and that's what you're doing today, right?
Yes, we are at four locations on the Iowa State campus. We're outside the Union Drive food court area. We are outside at Parks Library on campus. We are on Central Campus. And we are in front of the Maple Willow Large Dormitories on Beach Avenue from 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock. And then this afternoon, we're at the Ames Public Library from 1:30 to 5. So we've got about 15 volunteers from the League of Women Voters divided up between those. And we also have students at each of those locations, helping us to, you know, rope in the students to make sure they're they're registered at the current address. They move. You would think maybe yearly would be fine, but some of them move each semester. So each time they move, they need to be registered and updated. We never say, are you registered? We say, are you registered at your current address? Do you remember where you were registered the last time you voted? And they'll go, oh, I've moved. Well, they've all moved is really the bottom line. So, but there's so many issues that students have with the voting. You know, they can be registered at their home, wherever it is outside of Ames. They have a choice. And so we talk through that with them. Maybe they want to vote at home because their next door neighbor is a candidate on the ticket and that person's been like mom or dad to them their whole life. They want to vote for them. So, you know, you have to respect everything like that and give them those options. So what we don't do is we do not try to help them on how to register in their state. We give them a website, and Karen can kind of talk about that. The students can go anywhere to register. You know, it's a Q reader, I believe. Am I right, Karen?
It's a link, yeah.
It's a link, and they can go to that link and see how they need to be registered or what the deadlines are in those locations. So, but the deadline for being registered prior to the November 3rd election is October 24th.
October 24th, Saturday at 5 p.m.
There you go. I don't want to ever get into a position that we did not get a registration delivered or something like that. So far, the league has gone to many of the retirement communities and such, and we've given out close to 2,000 registration forms and absentee ballot request forms and instructions and for them to be registered and, you know, request their absentee ballots. That's been very well received by them, and I think Lucy can attest that you must have given them to Green Hills. You must have given them to Northcrest because she gets mail after we've done that. We're also have made packets for all the fraternities and sororities because you never know where they're going to live. And there were 4,000 of those forms that we made for that community of students here in Ames. We have given out the forms to new residents, and they partnered with their property management people. It's sort of like a new home packet. And then we send out emails to all these property management locations and giving them instructions to share with their residents via their email. They all have their resident emails. They send the email to all of them on how to be registered and how to get absentee ballot request forms. So we feel like we've really reached out. We'd like to reach out to the school districts in Story County, but we're going to wait and let them see how they're going to be doing their community schools and when they're going to start, and things keep happening just to protect the staff at those schools. Get them the forms. Many seniors can now vote, and who knows where, you know, whether they can get paper copies. It might be better for them to have email also. So that's the efforts of the league. We'll also be doing the same thing on September 22nd, locations on campus. That's National Voter Registration Day. So, and the good news is yesterday, Deary Brothers of Ames is giving us a white van. We're going to call it our suffrage voter van, and we're going to take it wherever anybody would like us to come and register, maybe outside of the mall, maybe at one of the commercial businesses. We're going to decorate it. We're going to put banners on it. If it's cool enough, we might wear a suffrage hat, and we will, you know, be there to meet everybody. And I'm just thank Deary of Ames for giving us that opportunity to reach out to the community.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. And I'm one of your hosts with Susan today. I'm Ursula, and I'm stepping in. Sorry, Susan, didn't mean to step on you. And we're talking about voting today. And welcoming Karen Kudrowski, who is the director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women in Politics and professor of political science at Iowa State University. We're celebrating Women's Equality Day and the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment for the women to vote. And so this is an auspicious celebration on many levels. Voting rights is a topic that is very hot today, as we've been hearing the first half of the show. It's still a topic of great concern, but it's certainly not new to the country. Accessing voting has been a struggle to be extended to many in this country since the beginning of this country. The 19th Amendment, you told me, Karen, was the amendment that historically was the largest expansion of voting rights. And it was initially introduced in Congress in 1878, but was not ratified into law until 1920. So thank you so much for coming to talk to us about the anniversary and the process of the 19th Amendment for women's suffrage. Tell us a little bit about the process, about how the states and how the federal government were involved with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the invitation. So 100 years ago today, Secretary of State Bainbridge Colby certified and officially added the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. And that enfranchised some 26 million women across the United States, or if the states had already granted full or partial suffrage, made sure that women had a constitutional guarantee of that of the right to vote. So in some states, they had already passed a law that had enfranchised women. So there were about 15 states that had granted full suffrage and about another dozen, including Iowa, that had granted what's known as partial suffrage. That might mean, for example, that women could vote for president, but they couldn't vote in any other races. In Iowa, women were allowed, if they were taxpayers, were allowed to vote on local bond issues, but nothing else. Another thing that I've heard a lot in the last 2 weeks as we have been commemorating the 19th Amendment's ratification is that it only applied to white women. That is not actually true. And the 19th Amendment was not restricted by race. And unfortunately, and to our collective shame, a number of states, not the federal government, continued to place barriers on people of color to be able to vote. But what we know is that outside the Deep South, which was most egregious in this, there were about 500,000 African-American women who were fully enfranchised as a result of the 19th Amendment, or if they had been previously enfranchised, such as in the states of California or New York, they now had a constitutional guarantee that that right to vote would not disappear by a state law that's passed at some other point.
So the 15th Amendment to the Constitution had already been passed prior to this, granting
The 15th Amendment was passed in 1870 after the Civil War, and it does not actually have the word male in it or sex. It just prohibits states from using race, color, or previous condition of servitude as a reason to deny suffrage. The 14th Amendment, which was passed 2 years earlier, is the one that inserts the word male into the Constitution. And it specifically defines citizens as male. And because of the 14th Amendment, that meant that the 15th Amendment only applied to African American men. Both the 15th Amendment and the 19th Amendment have language in them, and the 14th Amendment, that Congress can enforce the amendment with appropriate legislation. Congress did not, which is why the states were allowed to discriminate for so long and place so many barriers on people voting. It was not until 1965, with the passage of the Voting Rights Act, that we saw that Congress actually began to assert itself in terms of making sure that people of color were fully enfranchised.
So it's really, in a weird way, a back and forth between the states and the federal government. States have certain right. jurisdictions, and then the federal government also tries to come in and regulate how the states, in some ways, are carrying out their voting rights in the area.
Exactly. And as Lucy mentioned, states all have different laws related to voting. And the reason for that is that the Constitution gives states the power to determine the time, place, and manner of elections. And it also states, not until 1870 did the Constitution even begin to define who a voter should be. What the Constitution originally said was that the voters for the House of Representatives needed to be the same group of people who could vote for the largest chamber in the state legislature. That's all it said. So it really left it up to states to determine who could vote. And in the 1780s to 1824, only white male property owners were able to vote. And according to the National Archives, actually, that was only about 6% of the population. Right. So there were very few voters at the beginning of our democratic experiment. And the 15th Amendment and the 19th Amendment were both very contentious, in part because of the time, place, and manner clause. So it was very new that the federal government would step in and begin to define who a voter should be.
Yeah, you told me that the 19th Amendment was the 19th Amendment was only the second time
yes.
that the federal government actually got involved with voting laws.
Exactly. Yeah, in terms of defining who a voter is, mm-hmm. right? They had established Election Day and done some other things like that, but in terms of defining who a voter is, it was only the second time. The first time was the 15th Amendment. And when it came to the 19th Amendment, a lot of people in the South believed that the 15th Amendment was a mistake and it was federal overreach. And they believed that in an unspoken way, states outside the South agreed with it because they did not enforce it, mm-hmm. right? And then the 19th Amendment comes along and they see it as another example of federal overreach. And, you know, today we're really pretty comfortable with using the Constitution and federal laws to define who voters are. We've done it, you know, with, you know, extending presidential suffrage to the District of Columbia. We've, you know, extended lowered the minimum voting age to 18, that we passed the Voting Rights Act and amended it and renewed it regularly in the last 50 years. So, you know, today we're very comfortable with this, but 100 years ago, it was an extremely contentious issue.
It's very, very interesting to hear how this kind of gets worked out, how democracy takes many twists and turns. It's very interesting, and we're speaking with Karen Kedrowski, who's the director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics. And Karen, I would like to ask whether we can bring you back soon to talk about whether you think that the women's vote actually will play a role in this election. We're running out of time right now, but it's a topic I would love to explore with you. But before you go, just tell us for a moment about celebrations about the suffrage anniversary. How have they? I know that a lot was planned around the state to mm-hmm. celebrate all year long this anniversary, but then we came into a pandemic. So, what has happening with the celebrations and
right?
How does it
so
look?
So there is a group that has been working on commemorations across Iowa, and had planned events through the full calendar year of 2020. So at Iowa State, we had the kickoff of the official year of celebration in February. And there were 88 events that were on the Iowa calendar before the pandemic hit. And then most of them were postponed or canceled or looked to reschedule. And we have officially extended the year now through 2021.
Because we can do that, right?
Yeah, we can do that. And we really want to give the women and men who work so hard to extend suffrage to women the due for the hard work that they did. If they waited 72 years, we can wait a year to celebrate that. And one of the things that is still going on, though, is that the CAT Center worked with the Office on the Status of Women in the Central Iowa Community Museum to develop a traveling exhibit that focuses on African-American women from Iowa who were involved in the suffrage movement. It's called Toward a Universal Suffrage. It is right now at the Olawine Public Library. On Friday, I will pick it up and take it to University of Northern Iowa, but it is traveling around the state. We're very excited that it is getting in front of so many people as we gradually reopen and make our public spaces available.
Very interesting. Is there a website where somebody can go to find out?
It's 19th Amendment, so 19th-amendment.org, but if one not done, it pops up and you can see the calendar there. If you want information about where Toward a Universal Suffrage will be, go to the Central Iowa Community Museum. So just Google that, Central Iowa Community Museum, or you can send me an email. I'm on the Iowa State Directory. I'll be happy to direct you to where you can go see that exhibit. It will be in Urbandale and at Drake very shortly. So that's coming up, and we'll figure out where to put it on Iowa State when we have a free moment.
Okay, fantastic. I'd love to see it. And that was, again, hard won, not done. And this is Karen Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman CAT Center for Women in Politics and professor of political science at Iowa State. And will you come back and talk about your...
I would be delighted. Okay. Absolutely. Because that story is just as fascinating as the suffrage story.
Okay, well, it's a very relevant story today. So in a future show, we'll talk about what the effect of women voters actually could have on the whatever it is that we're going to be doing in November. It's going to be wild for sure. And as Lucy told us, it's quite something, quite an organizational task. Susan, I'm going to toss this back to you.
Well, this is KHOY Community Radio, Story City, Ames, and we're closing out our celebration of voting with a recognition of Executive Order Number 7, a restoration of voting rights for Iowans who had completed their felony sentence, and this was as of August 5th, 2020. In the wording in the governor's proclamation, in Iowa, a person's voter registration is canceled if the person is convicted of a felony, but the right to vote is restored by the governor upon completion of the felony sentence, as defined in Executive Order Number 7. If you have received a restoration of rights, including a restoration of rights under Executive Order Number 7, all you need to do to participate in elections in Iowa is register to vote at your current residential address. The ACLU of Iowa has been fighting for full restoration of rights, in fact, never taking them away for felons, since 2014, and only this year has this small victory been granted. I said earlier that we are still working on the of an earlier amendment that has to do with Black rights, which granted Black rights the right to vote. And to find out about that, we have Al Womble, chair of the Democratic Black Caucus, who's been working to increase political participation among Black citizens of Iowa. Welcome, Al. It's good to have you back on Local Talk.
Thank you once again for having me, Susan. It's always a pleasure to come on the show and talk to your audience. So thank you for having me.
I guess we have two questions for you because of the recent restoration of voting rights for felons, which is tens of thousands of people, right? Do you have any idea?
And that's going to be about 60,000 people.
And very high proportion of African Americans who were incarcerated. That should be a lot of new voters.
It should.
It seems to me they're doing everything they can to discourage them because the voter registration form hasn't been changed. Are you familiar with this?
That is correct, yes. So the current voter registration form has not been changed in order to update that particular information. And I think the thing that becomes more discouraging is, you know, the ability to reach these people where they are and make sure that they're getting this message. I am happy about the fact that the executive order was signed. There are some of us who still don't like the provisions in there about probation and parole, because that still limits it to then, whereas you would have 60,000 people that have their voting rights restored, now it's more down to like 40,000 people who are having their voting rights restored. And the problem is this information isn't necessarily being disseminated to the public in an appropriate manner that's helping everyone understand exactly what their rights now are, and helping get the information out there to, you know, those who have been convicted of felonies and should now be able to vote and participate in our democracy. And that is discouraging, but, you know, at the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, we are working very hard to try and reach out to those communities to talk to people, to educate people, and more importantly, encourage them to vote. You know, the most difficult thing that we're finding is that, you know, these people have been...
It looks like we have temporarily lost Al. Al Womble was speaking about the ability for ex-felons to vote during this election. Susan, are you still here? Why don't you go ahead and explain a little bit what the concern is about getting the word out that actually people that have been felons can vote or not?
Well, the signing of the order, of course, was front page news. They brought Betty Andrews from the Iowa, Nebraska NAACP on, and she and Veronica Fowler from the ACLU were there for the big signing. And then they didn't update the forms. Is Al back?
It looks like he's trying to come back. So let's just... Are you back?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
here you are. So you were just in the process of telling us what the Democratic Black Caucus is doing to try and do outreach to African-American communities to let them know about the change in the law. How are you reaching out to them? How does that happen?
So there's a couple different ways. Number one, obviously, we are trying to use our website and our Facebook page to try and pump out information as much as humanly possible to do that. We're also going to be starting a postcard and a phone banking campaign. And more importantly, we have this upcoming Friday, September 18th, which is National Black Voter Day. And what we're planning to do is a series of different events leading up to that day, to help publicize it, to help people understand it, make sure that people participate. And then we've got events that we're actually planning in 10 different counties across the state of Iowa, trying to work with different community leaders in those areas to make sure that they're helping put on events that not only have voter registration and absentee ballot request forms, but also that we put on events that are meaningful within that community, reach out to people. I've put on several different voter registration booths all across the state of Iowa. And one thing I'll tell you is if you just decide you're going to stop and set up a table and a tent and have some forms there, people are going to walk by you and have no idea what you're doing. They might think you're selling insurance.
So what is a meaningful event?
So a meaningful event is going to encompass a couple different things. So the first thing we have to do is listen to the local leaders in that particular area. What can we do that will be meaningful to that community? Like here in Des Moines, some of the things that we've tried doing is making sure that we have not just the voter registration, but do we have other services there available for people as far as, you know, information on housing, information on jobs, and also making sure that we have things like, say, singers, spoken word artists, presenters, different things that people can come to that event and realize, you know what, we're not just going to shower you with a bunch of pamphlets and a bunch of leaflets, but we're also going to try and entertain you. And we're going to have community leaders come up and speak to you about different events that are affecting that community. And so that way we can offer a variety of different things. But like in Cedar Rapids, one of the things we're trying to do is also make sure that we have a distribution of, you know, different resources that people might need. I've been up there recently helping to clear debris and cut trees after that derecho came. I spent an entire day chopping wood with a double-bladed axe to try and, you know, yeah, I was literally Paul Bunyan for a day. So that was kind of fascinating. And, you know, so in that sense, when we talk about someplace like Cedar Rapids, how can we help organize with local leaders and other individuals across the state who are willing to give so that we can collect supplies that people need? Things like food, things like clothing, other materials that individuals might need. That need isn't quite as great in places like, say, Davenport or, you know, Des Moines, but making sure that we try to partner with people like, you know, Iowa Job Corps and other facilities, make sure that they have information there as well, is going to make it a more meaningful event to individuals. So that's why we say partnering with local leaders is going to be one of the most important things that we can do. Making sure that we talk to people in that area and say, okay, you know, what can we have at this event that will make it meaningful for individuals? But, you know, I do know that when you add that entertainment aspect to it as well, as far as having, you know, singers, spoken word artists, you know, having some presenters there that will be able to talk about issues that are relevant to that community, all drive people to that event more. And so then that way we're going to be able to increase the number of people that we're able to contact. We'll be able to increase the number of voter registrations that we get, the number of absentee ballot requests that we get. And like I said, this is a multi-county effort. It's going to stretch from coast to coast, from the Mississippi to the Missouri. And so, yeah, I know we've got two coasts here in Iowa. We do.
Al, I know that Susan has a few more questions she wants to ask you before the show ends. But Susan, may I ask him one more question?
I
was curious, in your outreach efforts, has there been any connection with the Black Lives Matter movement in terms of reaching people who might not normally be associated with the Democratic Party?
Well, that's a good question. You know, we try to work with a variety of different people. We realize that, you know, with the Black Lives Matter movement, there are some people who have been involved in that who are now involved in the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus. You know, we've got some great young leaders who have gotten involved with us. I think, though, that with Black Lives Matter, they try to be a little bit more nonpartisan, if that makes sense. Whereas we, you know, as the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, we are an official arm of the Iowa Democratic Party. So we don't necessarily want to do anything that is going to limit their capabilities. And, you know, and I would hate to ever do anything to speak for them. You know, I'm chair of the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus. I don't necessarily have a leadership role in Black Lives Matter. So I try not to speak on their behalf because I've found that, you know, that's just not appropriate for me to do.
So you're staying in your lane.
Yeah. I mean, and see, but that's the important thing. We all have very important roles to play. We all have very important lanes to travel in. And they are very successful and they're very effective in their lane. You know, and we are, you know, I believe very successful, you know, in our lane. And so it's giving, you know, them the respect. Of course, you know, anytime they wish to collaborate, you know, I would always like to be able to take that chance. But at the same point in time, I don't want to do anything where I'm either A, speaking on their behalf, or B, because of us being an arm of the Democratic Party, limiting them because of that particular association that we have and what they might like to do.
So have you, in your efforts to do the outreach, have you found that this issue that Susan brought up is a real concern that people who may have a record of being incarcerated don't understand that they actually could vote this time, that because the language has not really been changed on the website or on the ballot?
I think that, yeah, the proper information is not out there. And even, you know, the information that is out there is not being properly disseminated to the public, meaning we don't have enough vehicles and we don't have enough outlets that's helping spread this information. And that's where it is up to us, you know, different volunteers, different citizens, to make sure that we're getting that information out there. The ACLU, the NAACP, the Iowa Democratic Black Caucus, Black Lives Matter, we're all doing everything we can to make sure that we're spreading this message and encouraging people to vote. You know, remember, like I said, when you suppress a particular population for so very long and then suddenly you say, hey, this has changed, they might be a little bit skeptical at first and be right. Like, wait, you're talking about what's going on here. You know, what does this really mean? Though I will say that there are some individuals that are very happy about this. I was at a voter registration event at an event called the Community Block Party, put on by Shireen Callister, who was actually on The Voice. And, you know, there was a gentleman who came up to register to vote and was nearly in tears out of joy that he had been waiting to vote. And now, for the first time, he was able to register and vote. And that was a very impactful moment. And when you saw the fact that, you know, he was able to vote again, it makes you realize that there are certain people who really understand that taking away my right to vote, to an extent, is taking away my humanity. It's saying that my voice doesn't count in your community. That dehumanizes somebody and removes them from society and continues a cycle of not just suppression at the voting box, but a certain amount of mental and emotional suppression. You know, I don't count. What does it matter? And part of our efforts have got to be counteracting that and letting people know you now have that chance to vote. You are now, you know, just as equal a member of society as anybody else. But we still have to work on, you know, a couple different things. One being the clauses in there on probation and parole, and making sure that eventually this becomes an amendment to the Iowa Constitution to make it permanent. An executive order can be overridden by the next executive.
So the work continues.
The work does continue, you know, and it has to pass through two sessions of the House in order for it to become, you know, an official amendment. So, you know, the battle is really just beginning.
And on that note, we have to end, Al. I hate to do this because it's a very interesting conversation. We're speaking with Al Wambold, chair of the Democratic Black Caucus in Iowa, who's been working to increase political participation among black citizens in Iowa. And Al, we have to have you back again. It's very, very interesting conversation. And as clearly the story is not finished yet. Susan, you and I have to end the show, right?
Yes, we do. But not before we let our listeners know about the big sale.
This coming weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, KHOI is doing a fundraiser at Paul Nelson's house here in Ames at 604 Hodge. And it is an estate sale plus. There is lots of more beautiful things in the house. Please come by to buy something. I've been there. It's really, there are really wonderful things there to buy. And all the money goes to support KHOI. We are running out of time, so I'm going to ask you to go to the KHOI website, which is khoifm.org for details. Again, that's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The times are there, and also a place where a number that you can call to reserve your shopping time, since we are limiting the number of people at a time in the house because of public safety. And this has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and saying thank you for listening. And Susan, you want to take us out?
Other voices you heard were Lucy Martin, Carolyn Klaus, Karen Kudrowski, and Al Womble. Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Little Rabbit from the CD Barn Owls Live. If you enjoy the show, tell your friends. Remember, what you buy at the estate sale will help make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.